You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The hit film The King's Speech depicts the relationship between the man who would become Britain's King George VI, a stutterer, and Lionel Logue, a self-taught speech therapist. If you haven't seen the film by now, no doubt you've heard a lot about it. It's won actor Colin Firth a Golden Globe Award, and it's also been nominated for 12 Academy Awards. A new book written by Mark Logue, Lionel Logue's grandson, and Peter Conradi reveals the real-life events behind the movie, The King's Speech, How One Man Saved the British Monarchy, is published by Sterling, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mark Logue to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Would you have written a book about your grandfather if the movie hadn't been made?
Possibly. I was researching into my grandfather in 2007. I was looking into his background. I'd begun reading the diaries which I'd discovered amongst my father's possessions in 2001. So yeah, the chances are something would have happened. Probably not quite as quickly and as with as much exposure as this at this time, yeah.
Well, you write in your introduction that as a boy growing up in Belgium, you knew your families had a link to royalty through your grandfather Lionel, but he was long dead before you were born, wasn't
That's
he?
That's right, yeah, 12 years before I was born. He died in 53. I was born in 65.
So was this one of the family stories you heard when you were growing up?
I didn't really hear much about it. My dad didn't talk much about it.
You would think he would have. This wasn't anything to be embarrassed about.
It wasn't anything. And it's just not one of these things, you know, I just never got around to asking him either. My dad passed away before I had a chance to really sort of interrogate him as an adult to adult. And I just took it for granted. There was this little shrine of pictures in the house where we lived, but autograph portraits from the king, but I didn't ask about them.
Have you spoken to any people who did know your grandfather?
Former patients of his, 10-year-old children who were wheeled into his office back in the 40s and 50s. I've spoken to since, yeah.
What did they think of Geoffrey Rush's portrayal of him?
Yeah.
I mean, they both have one thing in common. They're both from Australia.
Yeah. Most of their memories of my grandfather are pretty shaky. You know, most of them knew him sort of 50, 60 years ago. So, but from what they remember, it was pretty accurate. I mean, he was a warm, compassionate man. And so, that's what they remember.
Although your book reveals all sorts of things that the film didn't cover. And it also covers all sorts of years that the film doesn't deal with. But you said that there was a stack of photos. Wasn't there also a diary?
Well, he wrote the diary.
How did you gain access to that?
Well, it was passed down to me from my father in 2001. But then I discovered a second batch of diaries, journals, a diary that my grandmother wrote, and scrapbooks later on after as I was researching into the book, barely a month before the manuscript was due to be delivered, in fact. So we had to extend the deadline and work that in. But a whole other batch of letters and letters from the king, because beforehand my father had given me these pencil-written diaries and the pencil-written drafts of letters to the king from my grandfather, but not the replies from the king. So in this second sort of treasure trove was the second voice, you know, the king's voice back to Logue. So that made it complete.
So they saw each other on a regular basis for a while or irregularly, but they also corresponded?
Yeah, they saw each other intensively. From the first interview in 1926, 19th of October, 26, they saw each other about 50 appointments in as many days, running up to the King's opening of Parliament in Canberra. And then the kind of appointments diminish a bit. The Duke settles into his role and his royal duties, and he's confident and he doesn't need Logue so much. But then, of course, when he's kind of catapulted into the crown, his duties sort of become much more important and they resume sort of therapy together and until his death in 52.
The British newspapers often charted the Duke's progress as a speaker. And in June 12, 1928, the Standard wrote, The Duke has vastly improved as a speaker, and his hesitation has almost entirely gone. Well, that was just 2 years after your grandfather started working with him. Obviously, it wasn't a complete treatment.
No, I mean, his stutter had almost completely gone within 2 months of the treatment, but it was a temporary cure, you know. He taught the king how to cope with stammering, how to inhibit the urge to stammer, but it didn't go away completely. He continued. When he was anxious or tired, he stammered badly.
What did the king write to your grandfather?
A mixture, you know, either making future appointments or friendly letters, exchanging presents at birthdays and asking about each other's health and their children's health.
So they actually had some kind of a friendly relationship that went beyond the patient and we can't call him a doctor because he was really a self-taught speech therapist.
Yeah, none of the letters are particularly kind of formal and they're all very friendly. I mean, right the way through their relationship that spanned about 25 years, they wrote to each other pretty regularly right up until the end.
Well, how did this whole thing occur? How did your grandfather, who was born in Australia, wind up in London in the first place?
It's not exactly – I'm not exactly sure what made him come over. He lived in Perth in Western Australia, which is a small gold mining city. And I think they found themselves sort of big fish in a small pond, and they wanted to spread their wings and travel. They traveled in 1910. They came to Vancouver and visited Chicago and New York. And I think their kind of taste for travel was kind of whetted, and they wanted to kind of, you know, experiment and leave Australia.
And, to do what? Was he already thinking of being a speech therapist?
He was already a speech therapist. He was an elocution teacher in school. And he left when he was 44. He already had an established career in Australia. You know, he had a small theatre school. He was teaching elocution in schools. And so his move was like almost like, you know, I don't know why exactly he did it, but he had to start again, you know, start a new career in London. And within a couple of years, he set himself up in the heart of the British medical establishment in Harley Street. Clearly, with the confidence and the determination to make it there, and of course, he nets the big client.
Although not everyone respected him, a newspaper in the 1930s dubbed your grandfather the quack who saved a king. That's because he was self-taught. How do you teach yourself to be a speech therapist?
Well, there wasn't really any speech therapy to speak of at the time. It wasn't accepted medical. There was no accepted medical practice.
People assumed that this was a psychological problem, and your grandfather was saying, no, there is an actual physical or neurological problem.
That was his approach, yeah. He treated the physical problem, but obviously there was the psychological support that he gave the Duke of York in particular.
My guest is Mark Logue, who's written with Peter Conradi, The King's Speech, How One Man Saved the British Monarchy. It's being published by Sterling here in this country. Well, it was considered a psychological problem, and the Bertie, the Duke of York, thought it was a psychological problem, but would it have been considered unseemly for him to go into psychoanalysis, which was at some point Freud even winds up moving to London?
I can't imagine the Duke of York seeking, you know.
My mother never loved me.
Yeah, or my father, yeah.
In his case, my father.
Yeah. I don't think that would have been seemingly, you know, that would have been acceptable. I think what Logue did was this kind of covert psychoanalysis. It was sort of a way of treating the physical, but, being seen to treat the physical, but actually being there as quite a major psychological support as well.
Well, he once said that he could look at a group of people, even if he was out of earshot, and tell if one of the individuals had a speech impediment.
That's right, yeah.
Just by the struggle that the person was making to get the words out?
I don't know that.
No. Well, what age did the Duke begin to show signs of a speech impediment? Is this something that started just when he started learning how to speak?
I think he was quoted as saying that the first time he had it was aged six. He suffered badly through school. He was teased and, you know, labeled as a simpleton and was unable to answer simple sort of verbal tasks at school. So, yeah, he had a pretty bad time and his confidence was seriously knocked.
And in the film, it seems rather extraordinary that he would wind up, or at least his wife would wind up, going to someone like Lionel Logue seeking for help. But is that pretty much what happened?
Yeah, they when the Duke following the Wembley disastrous Wembley speech, he had been given this appointment, this royal duty, to go and open Parliament in Canberra barely a year later. And so in an attempt to kind of get himself, it was basically determined to kind of get himself cured, or, you know, he got Logue's help. And in the first few months, you know, from the first interview, he basically manages to turn it around.
What did Logue do to help him turn it around?
Breathing exercises and, you know, speaking out of open windows and enunciating vowels and, you know, all of those exercises, the sliding, the techniques to overcome the urge to stammer. All that we see in the film. Well, actually, not technically all that we see in the film, but there are some things that are slightly imaginative, but yeah.
Although the writer of the film, David Seidler, had something of a personal connection to the story, didn't he?
Yeah, he himself suffered from a stammer as a child, and this was something of a cathartic process, I think, for him to write this screenplay in 81. He drew a lot of what he wrote, he drew from personal experience.
So he wrote it a long time ago, and it's just taken all these years to be produced?
Yeah, the story was that he wrote it in 81. He sought permission to get access to the letters that my uncle had at the time. My uncle passed the inquiry on to Clarence House, and the Queen Mother replied to Seidler directly, flatly refusing access to the royal letters, stating that she found the memories too painful, and that she'd prefer the film wasn't made in her lifetime. Well, it took 25 years. Eventually, she passed away, and Seidler resumed the project.
The film also suggests that there was we can't call it a class issue here because we're talking about a royal, but definitely a problem of somebody who was next in line at a certain point to become the king, seeking help from some self-taught speech therapist from Australia. Do the diaries and the letters reveal that something like that actually was happening?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
The whole matter of the prince every so often, the Duke every so often taking offense, for example, when Lionel Logue tries to make them into equals and calls him Birdie. Britain has a strong sense. There's a, you know, the whole class issue in England has always been a major problem. Add to this the fact that we're talking about a man who is a royal.
Yeah, I mean, Logue, without a doubt, Logue must have broken through that kind of the walls that the Duke of York were sort of put up around him, both metaphorical and literal sort of barriers of, you know, etiquette and royal protocol. But there's nothing in the diaries to suggest that they actually broke through that much and called each other by their first names. I mean, from the letters, there's always this kind of mark of respect. Logue always addresses him, the Duke of York, as your Royal Highness, and later as Your Majesty. And the Duke of York in return writes very friendly headed letters saying, "My dear Logue," and so it's very respectful. And
well, the film ends in 1939, but they continued their relationship until their deaths, didn't they, in the 50s?
Yeah, 1952, the king died. Lowe passed on about a year later.
Did they continue to meet on a regular basis?
I'm not sure if they met. They met for the therapy sessions, but...
Because the king continued to need this kind of therapy?
The king made Christmas broadcasts and had Lowe in attendance for every broadcast he made until 1944. That was the first speech he made unattended. After that, he saw him less and less, but they kept in touch.
Now, one of the things that you know from personal experience to be true in the film is the whole matter of reciting Shakespeare.
Mm.
That's because your father had you do something similar?
Yeah, the scene in the film where Geoffrey Rush has the boys recite Shakespeare or try and guess the play as he starts to recite it had certain resonances with me because I remember as a child similar, not exactly the same, but a similar kind of scene where, he'd asked me to memorize and recite and not just Shakespeare but poetry. And he was a lover of poetry and obviously his father had made him memorize this stuff. And seeing that scene being filmed, made hairs on the back of my neck stand up because it sort of kind of made it sort of real for me.
What were you doing growing up in Belgium?
My father was a company man. He was a corporate lawyer for P&G, and that's where they stationed him.
But he had no thought of also becoming a speech therapist, just a lover of speech.
That's right, yeah. No, he didn't. He didn't enter medicine or he'd studied law.
What is Peter Conradi's role in the creation of this book?
He co-authored it with me. The labor was divided between me. I largely focused on transcribing the archives and producing material which he could easily digest, and his background in knowledge in early 20th century history and the interwar years helped lay down that foundation.
Were the filmmakers okay with you using the same title that they used for the film?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I negotiated early on in the deal.
The King's Speech, How One Man Saved the British Monarchy, published by Sterling. My great thanks to Lionel Logue's grandson, Mark Logue, for being on our show today. He wrote it with Peter Conradi.
Thank you very much.
¶¶